Okay, for our afternoon plenary session on the BP oil spill, Mark Schlefstein is moderating it. He's no stranger to SEJ. As Mark likes to describe himself, he is the alleged environment writer for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. He's a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, a former SEJ board member, and he brought this conference to his town of New Orleans several years ago. It took someone of Mark's stature and staying power to assemble this panel. Believe me, it was difficult. Mark?
Thank you. In their new book, Blowout in the Gulf, to be released in a couple of weeks, SEJ member Bill Freudenberg and co-author Robert Gramling point out that BP's oil well shares the same name as the fictional town in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel 100 Years of Solitude, and point out how prescient Marquez may have been with this quote from the novel. It was as if God had decided to put to the test every capacity for surprise and was keeping the inhabitants of Macondo in a permanent alternation between excitement and disappointment, doubt and revelation, to such an extreme that no one knew for certain where the limits of reality lay. Today, we have a panel that I hope will be able to better define those limits. On my far right, Jane Lubchenco, a marine ecologist and environmental scientist, is the ninth administrator and first woman administrator of NOAA. From 1999 to 2009, she led PISCO, a large four-university interdisciplinary team of scientists investigating the large marine ecosystem along the coasts of Washington, Oregon, and California. And she served as president of a variety of scientific organizations and also has helped to co-found three organizations that communicate scientific knowledge to the public, policymakers, industry, and, of course, us, the media. The Leopold Leadership Program, Compass, and Climate Central. To her left is Chris D'Elia. He's been dean of the Louisiana State University School of the Coast and Environment since July of 2000. Prior to that, he was associate research and professor of marine sciences at the University of Florida at St. Petersburg, and earlier was director of the Maryland Sea Grant Program for the University of Maryland College System from 1989 to 1999. And he's also a former president of the Estuarin Research Foundation. I should also point out that Chris is attending SEJ this year as part of the University of Rhode Island Metcalf Institute of Marine Sciences grant underwritten by the National Science Foundation Rapid Grant Program for the oil spill. And it's aimed at improving the public understanding of the oil spill's impacts and the specific scientific techniques used to assess those impacts. And I should also point out that Chris has agreed to step in after Interior Assistant Secretary Tom Strickland canceled because of an unavoidable last-minute schedule conflict. And the Interior Department was unable to provide a substitute to answer questions about Bureau of Ocean Energy Management issues. To his left is Doug Rader, who's the Chief Ocean Scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund and works with national and regional teams on emerging ocean issues. He has a doctorate in biology and a master's in zoology and has been a key player in EDF's response to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, in part because of his work on behalf of stronger fisheries management and conservation policies and coastal habitat protection programs. And I should also point out that Doug agreed to step in at the last minute after EDF's L.G. Holstein had to attend to a family matter. And to his left, to my right, is Kyle Issacauer, who serves as Vice President for Regulatory and Economic Policy at the American Petroleum Institute, the primary national trade association for America's oil and natural gas industry. In this role, he leads APA's climate policy development, oversees the establishment of environmental and tax policies and manages the development of API standards and economic and statistical analyses in support of advocacy and outreach efforts. Most certainly will see that there does seem to be someone else missing from our podium, and that is BP. And I will tell you that I made repeated attempts to get BP to come today, and that they did not agree that this was a place that they should be. So I'll leave that at that. Now, let me just talk about blame here for a second, okay? And I'm going to talk about blame that goes to us, the reporters. I know that there is going to be a lot of patting on the back about how good the coverage was of this oil spill, this disaster, over the next couple of months as the awards season begins. But I want everybody in this room to remember what we didn't do. And I include me in those we. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, the one thing that Katrina taught a number of people, including some of us at our newspaper and many people in the engineering community, was that ignoring residual risk you do only at your own peril. And just like with the levee system of New Orleans, we ignored residual risk in the offshore community. We had the opportunity to write stories well in advance of this disaster about the potential for residual risk, and to be honest, we blew it. There was no washing away, washing up on shore for this event from any newspaper in the United States. So with that as my mea culpa, let me turn the program over to Jane Lubchenco. The way this is going to work is we're going to give a couple of minutes each to each of our speakers here. Then I'm going to ask a couple of questions, and then we're going to throw it open to the audience. So, Jane.
Thanks, Mark. Hi, everybody. It's great to be here. SEJ is one of my favorite meetings, so it's really a treat to be able to be with you. What I'd like to do is just make some opening remarks to get some ideas on the table and to lay out some common understanding of some of the things that happened during this event. And I'm going to do that using some overheads, so bear with me for just a minute here. And I want to read some of my remarks just because I want to get things out. So there you go. So what I'd like to do is offer some insights and reflections on the Deepwater Horizon disaster, specifically on NOAA's roles and responsibilities. And I'm doing this both as administrator of NOAA as well as a scientist who cares really deeply about the use of science on an ongoing basis in management and policy, but especially during a crisis. The focus here is on lessons learned, and I think lessons learned serve a vital purpose. They're really the tools that we have to inform how we respond to, how we anticipate, how we prepare for similar or dissimilar situations in the future. And although one can begin to capture lessons learned during a crisis, I think oftentimes it's a situation where some distance is needed to really truly reflect on all of the lessons learned. We're in the early phases of this analysis about lessons learned. This is not the end, just the beginning. However, part of our analysis of Deepwater Horizon, I think, needs to begin with a focus on the Exxon Valdez oil spill, because that really did set the stage for how we thought about spills and how we responded to this particular one. The EVOS experience led to new legislation, specifically the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. That act enabled, guided, and constrained the response to Deepwater Horizon. For example, OPA, the Oil Pollution Act, specified a new relationship with the responsible party and set up a trust fund that provided scientific independence for the natural resource damage assessment process, as well as funding opportunities for third-party claims. And EVOS also presented a number of lessons learned about how to deal with a spill. And so when Deepwater Horizon reared its ugly head, one of the first things I asked for as administrator was an analysis of lessons learned from EVOS. And fortunately, we at NOAA had access to a number of people with deep experience in the Exxon Valdez spill. For example, Dave Kennedy on the left here in the slide, who served as scientific support coordinator for the Exxon Valdez oil spill, he headed up NOAA's Deepwater Horizon team. Our team also dusted off a lot of the lessons learned, both lessons that we learned at NOAA, but also ones that had been written up by other people. And so we fed that into the way we were thinking about and responding to Deepwater Horizon. As a result, we were able to incorporate knowledge gained during or in our response. For example, we learned to, or we were aware of the importance of being wary of response activities that would cause more damage than, in fact, they were, that more harm than good, if you will. For example, in Exxon Valdez, power washing the shore, I think in hindsight, is very widely recognized to have caused an inordinate amount of damage. Similar to that, walking around in oil-drenched wetlands in the Gulf trying to remove oil, when doing so would likely just bury oil deep into the sediment. So we knew that those were some things to be avoided. We also knew to pay close attention to the impacts of hydrocarbons on juvenile and larval fish, not just adults who metabolize hydrocarbons very rapidly. And so some of the work that had been done in the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez spill that told us that, in fact, the cardiac development of larval fish was seriously impaired by exposure to hydrocarbons was important information. So my first point is that we benefited immensely from lessons from Exxon Valdez where there were parallels. However, in many ways, Exxon Valdez was completely unlike the Deepwater Horizon. Exxon Valdez involved a known quantity of oil. It happened in very shallow and very cold waters, involved a very different type of oil, and washed up on mostly rocky and gravelly shores. So very, very different from the situation that we had in the Gulf. The Exxon Valdez experience could not tell us how oil would behave when gushing continuously for 3 months from more than a mile under the surface. It could not tell us how sweet Louisiana crude was different and would behave differently in warm Gulf waters at the beginning of the hurricane season and with a fickle loop current as its sidekick. It could not tell us what technologies might be effective in stopping the flow of oil from a mobile offshore drilling unit of this type more than 5,000 feet below the surface. In other words, Deepwater Horizon was unlike any other spill we have had to date. In fact, the word spill is a misnomer. It's misleading. And I can tell you from personal experience that the disaster was simply outside the envelope of anyone's expectation about a spill. Admiral Allen used to use the terms omnidirectional and indeterminate. I think those were appropriate. Unprecedented is also apt, but actually all those fail to capture the reality of dealing with 5 million barrels of oil gushing forth for 3 months. That's one Exxon Valdez spill every 4.5 days. 18 to 19 Exxon Valdez oil spills in total. And it was coming from a mile down, so the oil behaved very differently. Yes, in hindsight, a disaster of this magnitude and from this depth should have been anticipated. And you can be sure there are lots of discussions underway about why it wasn't and what changes should be put in place for the future. Nonetheless, I am very proud and impressed with the response effort. It was aggressive, it was science-based, and it was adaptive. The sheer magnitude of the effort is astounding. 6,000 vessels out on the water, over 43,000 people, more than 10 million miles of boom. All of that needed to be coordinated, focused on the most important tasks, communicated, and adaptively managed continuously as new information came to the fore or new problems surfaced. And as the lead agency responsible for science of oil spills in marine and coastal environments, NOAA indeed had its hands more than full. NOAA was responsible for 5 different categories of activities. If I can get the next slide coming, it will tell you that. Okay, so we're not quite there. I'm going to flip through this. NOAA is responsible for 5 different things during the spill. Not sure where I should be pointing this. There we go. Okay, here we go. We conduct and we share science. We keep seafood safe. We protect wildlife and habitats. We assess damage because of the spill. And we restore the natural resources injured as a result of the spill. And science underpins all of those. Conducting science meant that we had maps showing where the oil likely would go, and we produced oil trajectories, forecasts, twice a day, initially within hours of the initial explosion, and then every day for nearly 4 months. Keeping the seafood safe meant closing fisheries, yet leaving areas open where they were safe so that fishermen had a lifeline. And we reopened fisheries only where three criteria were met. One, no sheen had been observed for at least 30 days. Two, the area must not be likely to become contaminated by oil. And three, seafood from the area had to pass a very stringent, rigorous laboratory test to ensure that it was free from oil or dispersant contaminants. Only if all criteria were met were areas opened. And in addition, NOAA and the Food and Drug Administration are conducting dockside and market-based sampling as extra measures of safety. So under the watchful eyes of science, we have gone from 37% of federal waters closed to fishing to, with the latest opening today, 7% remaining closed. Another area of our responsibility was protecting wildlife and habitats. The Gulf is home to 5 of 7 endangered species worldwide. 593 sea turtles were found dead in the aftermath of this event, or during this event. But an aggressive effort was launched to rescue and rehabilitate 537 sea turtles. Protecting wildlife also meant that we would relocate loggerhead turtle nests full of eggs because the scientists determined that this would be the best way to keep them out of harm's way. Assessing the damage meant identifying species and investigating wetlands, marshes, open waters, and sea bottom communities from day 3 of the spill, using a workforce of over 40 NOAA damage assessment teams in the field every day. An assessment also means using the best science while ensuring that our legal obligations are met. Restoring natural resources and wetlands, as we look to restoring the Gulf, we fully understand that this means both the ecosystem of the Gulf, the multiple types of habitats and species in the Gulf, but also the communities and the economy that they underpin. In this way, NOAA's mission goes well beyond data and numbers. It's really about the people of the Gulf. And we are only now beginning to examine the response to Deepwater Horizon for the lessons learned. In realizing the limits of the lessons that Exxon Valdez could teach us, we need to ask the hard questions about how well the reforms that came out of the Exxon Valdez served us in the Deepwater Horizon, and what else needs to be done to prevent future spills and deal with them should they happen. One major challenge that's glaringly obvious in the Deepwater Horizon experience is the lack of funds for immediate response as well as sustained engagement by the academic community who have so much to offer. Our commitment to partnering with them on the subsurface monitoring that is underway now is a good step, but we need much more sustained partnership on an ongoing basis. And finally, we need to be more effective in communicating what was happening, when it was happening, in ways that are understandable. For us, for the federal family, it means articulating our messages and intents clearly. And for you, the environmental reporters, it means understanding the scientific enterprise as the context for response, recovery, and now for restoration. Though the oil has stopped flowing, NOAA is still hard at work. And as we go about the hard work of rebuilding the Gulf, the things that we are focused on now are very much the kinds of things that people want from the Gulf. They want to be able to eat Gulf seafood safely, fish from Gulf waters safely, and swim safely in the Gulf once again. Eat, swim, fish, and do so with joy. As we move forward with closing the chapter on response and opening the chapter on restoration, I look forward to working with all of you to communicate science in a way that truly upholds the values of science and journalism as its best, being objective, being transparent, and being willing to ask the tough questions about what should have what did we do well, and what should we have done differently? Thank you.
Chris?
Well, I'm delighted to be here and am pleased to stand in on short notice. I haven't prepared a long list of remarks, but I did want to make a couple of comments about the perspective of a dean who is down there running a school of coast and environment in so near an oil spill. First, I come to the media with a fair amount of experience, so it was a bit fortunate that I had this experience, because I never anticipated in my life the kind of media attention that I'd be getting when I came to LSU and that my colleagues would be getting. My college alone, which consists of about 40 of us, had over 2,500 media interviews since this oil spill began. It is truly astonishing, and it occupied a lot of our time. I've been involved with some important environmental stories in the past, one with the Chesapeake Bay as an assistant professor, another with coral bleaching back in 87 when I testified to Congress about that, and then finally Fisteria in 1997 on the Chesapeake. All of them were very hot topics, but didn't approach what we've seen in this particular case. I think the reporting has been generally pretty good of the science that I've been involved with, and I know my school has felt pretty good about things, but it has been uneven in some respects. A couple of stories that I haven't liked particularly were out of Alabama, as it happens. One was a story about an exploding separatory flask in which somebody who was represented as a scientist did some arm waving and actually showed a flask explode that he said he got from an oil enriched sample off the coast of Alabama, and I don't think that was either accurate or correct. Another story that has gotten way too much attention is the idea that scientists were being bought off by BP in around the Gulf so that they couldn't participate in the NERDA activities on the federal side or in other research. And there are certainly some people who are under contract with BP, but I'm not aware that there are nearly as many people as were represented to be. And certainly in my school, which kept appearing in these news reports as one of the schools that was bought off, I've only identified a couple of people who have any real relationship contractually with BP. So that did irritate me. But by and large, the science side has been covered conscientiously and by an incredibly broad group of reporters from literally all over the world. This is an extremely tough science issue, and I don't want to seem critical of the federal agencies at all for what they did in the oil response, which was truly remarkable, and Jane just mentioned the enormous response with over 40,000 people involved in the cleanup and over 6,000 vessels. It was truly an amazing activity to coordinate with a very moving target, and one that just never seemed to go away and was very, very very demoralizing to us all. I think that she mentioned something that she's not happy with. She was down to visit us at LSU very recently and also mentioned it at that time, and it's something that I have been pushing on a great deal, is the need to have more funding for independent science, apart from the NERDA process and apart from BP's efforts to defend itself in that process. And I think that is not a deficiency of the administration's response as it is a deficiency in the actual legislation of OPA. And I hope that in future reauthorizations of that law that we can see a change made. I think the adding of independent science from the academic community is very helpful to the federal agencies. Actually, we can say things that they can't say, and get away with it. To be blunt with you, if we say that the extent of the oil is not as great, or the effects are not as serious as might be anticipated, we can say that publicly. For Lisa Jackson or Jane Lubchenco to make a statement like that would lead them to be accused of being in the back pocket of the oil company. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that is the case, but I think that is a very important element of it. I would say the biggest concern I have now about press coverage in the future is, will this story persist? Is it now regarded as simply over because it did not appear to have been, at least in the acute phase, as serious an issue as we feared it might be? My concern is really long range, and it will take years of observation, monitoring, and research to determine the exact effects, but I'm very concerned about the effects on living resources, particularly fisheries, food chains, food webs, very vulnerable species, such as bluefin tuna, and also in wetlands, where we already have a monumental problem in Louisiana, losing more wetlands than anybody else in the nation, and facing the highest relative rates of sea level rise in the nation of up to 10 millimeters a year. So that's the question I have for all of you is, will this story persist? Will you follow it when it's not quite the hot item? And with that, I'll end my comments.
Doug?
Like Chris, I'm delighted to be here. Missoula in October, SEJ, what's wrong with that? Sure, absolutely. And I do bring you greetings from L.G. Holstein, who was unable to come and who's been my partner, like many of you, every day since April, trying to figure out where this is taking all of us together. And I do suspect that everyone is in this room has some personal twist to this story, and I'll tell you mine. On April the 13th, exactly a week before the Deepwater Horizon exploded, I signed, as co-chair for the state of North Carolina, a final report of 2 years of highly technical work on the likely implications of offshore drilling and other offshore energy production opportunities for the state of North Carolina. Done, right? And then a week later, it was all, not all wasted, but certainly some of the major assumptions were outdated, including, among a lot of other things, total assurance, both from the Minerals Management Service and from industry, that what had happened in Santa Barbara in 1969, what had happened at Ixtoc in 1979, what had happened in the East Timor Sea in 2009 simply could not, it was impossible, could not happen in the United States waters. So what I'm going to do is share just a few lessons, and we'll have some time to talk about all these things, and if we don't get to it up here, please pin me before I leave, because I've got a lot of other things that I'd like to talk about. But the main challenge, the very bottom line, is we all know, it's really clear, that America needs safe, secure, affordable energy and a portfolio that is compatible with long-term environmental health and social well-being. Right? Right. We know that transitioning from a fossil fuel-based energy economy requires more natural gas at some scale, and that's got to come from somewhere. That makes more OCS, Outer Continental Shelf development, in my view, inevitable. In fact, that makes more drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, the shared Gulf of Mexico, inevitable. In U.S. waters, in Mexican waters, in Cuban waters, and we can talk about that. I've been working for more than 10 years now in Cuba, including with energy there, and most recently in Bahamian waters. So oil industry is a piece of the future for the Gulf of Mexico and needs to be factored in. It's really clear, therefore, that the lessons of the Macondo BP oil disaster have to be learned, and they have to be learned fast. We need to share knowledge as effectively as we can. We need to share knowledge about control technologies, about event response, about basic ecological processes to be able to minimize risks and then minimize impacts once the risks can no longer be minimized. It's abundantly clear about some of those lessons are, quickly, that government oversight has to keep pace with the growing risk and complexity of offshore deepwater drilling. Permit approvals, unannounced inspections, all of those things have to come into the modern age. It's abundantly clear that government capacity, technical know-how, has to be enhanced to move up to that increasing complexity in dealing expeditiously with the next crisis as it develops. It's abundantly clear that industry response preparedness also has to increase markedly in order to make performance next time by the conjunction of government and industry much better than happened this time around. And therefore, the coordination among those partners in dealing with such emergencies much better than this time. To be blunt about it, I think everyone did a fabulous job with what they already had, but the assumptions going into the process were such as they were flying nearly blind in many cases. And that's simply not something that we can tolerate as a society going forward. So environmental planning and response absolutely has to be designed to take into account true worst-case scenarios. We all know the costs of doing that, of preparing for really extreme, really rare events. But I hope we've learned the lessons of failing to do that. And just as an aside, this, and let's talk about it if you want to, this was not a worst-case event. I know we won't like to think that it was, but the happenstance of the formation of Eddie Franklin between June the 1st and June the 3rd kept oil that was on the surface being delivered and induced a closure all the way to the Dry Tortugas on exactly June the 3rd. And by the way, impinging on 150 linear miles of Cuban exclusive economic zone at the time, kept that oil from being delivered downstream to very sensitive coral reefs on the north shore of Cuba and also in the Florida Keys and beyond as far as North Carolina, where I live, converting the Central Gulf into a massive fermenter, a black hole to pull whatever was being delivered through the current system into a biological system where it could be broken down and much of its total effect attenuated. I'm not trying to suggest that we actually dodged the bullet, because I don't think we did. And I think the toll of impacts has yet, as Dr. Lubchenco suggested, has yet to be fully written, that there are many out-of-sight and out-of-mind ecological elements that took it on the chin. I'll be glad to list for you, if you want to, what my candidates for what those are. Dr. Lubchenco mentioned some of them, the small out-of-sight, out-of-mind things on the surface, the larvae, but also the denizens of sargassum seaweed on the surface, the midwater fauna that have been not in most people's reporting but are key prey for all of the important things on the surface like whales and billfish and dolphins and bluefin tuna and all that kind of stuff, and then the out-of-sight and out-of-mind things on the bottom, the deep-water coral reefs that have been under the plume since day one around Vallasca Knolls, and then many benthic bottom-dwelling habitats that not only are interesting in their own regard, but also are key prey for bottom-feeding fishes, providing a pathway for oil-based material, once it's on the bottom, to be re-inoculated into both ecological food chains and human food chains. I do think that it's what you get when you put three ecological PhD scientists on the podium. But I think the investment that our nation had made in understanding the underlying ecology of the Gulf was just a pittance compared to what was necessary to be able to figure out exactly what was injured and exactly what needs to be done to figure that out, either in a monitoring context or simply to know what happened. There's virtually no baseline data on those midwater systems in the Gulf of Mexico. It's really clear that a serious investment in basic science, basic ecosystem monitoring, tied to those elements of the ecological systems that are most likely to be damaged is going to be essential. And so the bottom line, as Chris said, is that the Gulf Coast has been taking it on the chin for many generations, the wetlands and other things. I hope that BP will be a clarion call to action, both in terms of a reinvestment in Gulf Coast restoration and also as a sea change for environmental policy making. While it may not happen like it happened after Santa Barbara, that brought us the National Environmental Policy Act and much the formation of the Minerals Management Service, nonetheless, there are real important changes to be made. And in the long run, we simply can't afford to revert to business as usual. Thank you.
Kyle?
Let me start by referring to the priorities of the oil and gas industry. Our priorities have and always will be the safety of our workers and the responsible development of our nation's energy resources. Our goal has and will continue to be zero accidents and zero spills. Clearly, things went horribly wrong on April 20th. This has served to spur the oil and gas industry into action and into reassessing our activities, and really has been an acknowledgement, has created an acknowledgement on behalf of the industry that we must improve. A number of people on the panel have already said that this was not foreseen, and that's true, it was not foreseen. However, going forward, we now need to look and have been looking at our practices to ensure that that another Deepwater Horizon does not occur. And let me talk a little bit about what actions the oil and gas industry has taken. First of all, immediately following the Deepwater Horizon incident, all other Deepwater rigs in the Gulf of Mexico were inspected. Now, that's fine. That's the government's job, and they did that. All those rigs were identified as meeting government standards. Now, the industry did not rest on that. We recognized that we needed to reevaluate our own performance, and we needed to reevaluate our own procedures. And in fact, what we did initially is we created four joint industry task forces. Now, these were four task forces that were staffed by the best and brightest minds from 75 different companies, six different trade associations in the oil and gas industry. And they looked at various activities associated with deep water drilling. And those four task forces covered offshore equipment, offshore operational practices, spill response, and subsea well control. And they very quickly, with a great deal of effort, looked top to bottom and identified many ways in which we can improve our procedures and improve our performance. DOI thought enough of the recommendations that came from these four task forces that those recommendations, many of those recommendations, were included in first the 30-day report that DOI submitted to the president, also in their notice to lessees, and then just earlier this week in their interim final rule. So clearly, the industry has been taking a very hard look at our policies, our practices, and the government has identified that many of those, most of those, recommendations are good ones and will improve our performance going forward. In addition, four of our largest oil and gas companies operating in the Gulf have pledged $1 billion to create a startup company which should be founded within the next couple of weeks. And that startup company will provide containment equipment, resources, that can be used by any operator in the Gulf going forward, so that if, God forbid, there is another accident again, that those equipment can be quickly mobilized and we won't have a three-month release into the Gulf. It'll be much shorter than that. Now, keep in mind, this is a $1 billion investment in resources that we hope to never use and we anticipate never using. So clearly there has been not only a commitment from the oil and gas industry on improving our practices, but we're putting our money where our mouth is. Now, let me talk just for a minute or two on the moratorium. Obviously, the moratorium, Deepwater moratorium, was lifted earlier this week, and we applaud the Department of Interior's actions. However, we need to be clear that this is a first step. This does not restore drilling in the Gulf. This is the first step, a necessary one, but Department of Interior needs to be staffed. Right now, given the new rules that the industry is going to be working under and the new requirements from the regulators, they are woefully understaffed. They cannot work with the regulated community to identify what new permit new permit applications are going to look like. And they certainly cannot, given current staffing, process the number of permits that are going to be coming in to them in very short order. So essentially what we have, if we cannot adequately staff DOI, is we're going to have a moratorium which sunsets and leads to a de facto moratorium. Because without a permit, there's no activity. And let's be clear, it's very important that we do restart activity in deep water. It's important from an economic standpoint, and it's important from an energy security standpoint. Economically, deep water activity in the Gulf supports about 170,000 jobs in the Gulf region. It's a very important economic driver for that area. In terms of energy security, it was said before, oil and gas is here to stay. While we certainly encourage the development of renewables and alternative lower carbon energy sources, realistically, they are not going to be a significant part of our energy mix anytime soon. The Energy Information Administration currently identifies that 60% of our nation's energy demand is met by oil and gas. They project that in year 2035, that will be 55%. And this is with a growing energy need. So you're talking about absolute energy demand from oil and gas, which remains flat, according to the Energy Information Administration. Oil and gas is needed. The Gulf of Mexico supplies 30% of our nation's oil demand. 80% of the oil from the Gulf of Mexico comes from deep water. It is essential, both from an economic and an energy security standpoint, that we resume operations in the Gulf. The industry has demonstrated its commitment to improving performance, to ensuring that another accident like Deepwater Horizon does not happen again, and we are committed to working with the Department of Interior to ensure that that is the case. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so I'm going to start off the questions with a couple for each person up here. And Dr. Lubchenco, I'm afraid I have to begin with the pie chart. On the day that the pie chart was released, I was not listening to the press conference. I did not listen to the morning talk shows. I got the press release, and I went and grabbed the pie chart, and I looked at it, and I started doing some counting. And I saw direct recovery from wellhead, 17%. Well, that's gone. Burned, 5%. That's gone. Skim, 3%. That's gone. And then I looked at the rest of it, and I said, well, evaporated or dissolved. Okay, so let's say half of that amount evaporated. That's gone. Well, the rest of it's still there. But when I looked on the wires after I read this, I started seeing these stories saying, well, there's only 25% left in the Gulf of Mexico. How did that happen, that message ended up being what it became? And was that an accurate portrayal that the media gave to what y'all were saying that morning? And what can we do about what is now in the Gulf? Are there reconsiderations of how much oil is out there?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark, thanks for the opportunity to address a topic that has been surrounded by a lot of confusion. I think that the bottom line is that that pie chart was intended to give a sense of where this almost 5 million gallons went. And in broad terms, about a quarter of it was removed from the system completely by the response action. Removed, direct capture, skimmed, burned. About a quarter of it was evaporated or dissolved. And so another quarter was dispersed, either chemically or naturally, which means that it's most definitely was still in the system at some time. But what is unknown is exactly the rate of biodegradation of that. So we're not assuming that all of the oil that was released is still out there. The remaining quarter is the residual, i.e., what's left over after you have removed what you can measure directly or estimate with some degree of confidence. And that other quarter is washed up on beaches, some of which has been recaptured, has light sheen or tar balls, so you just can't measure that very easily. So I've consistently said that on the order of about half of the oil of that 5 million barrels has been removed from the system. There's been a lot of confusion about different things that different people said about it, but I've been pretty consistent in saying exactly what I just told you. So that means that the part that we remain very, very concerned about is this quarter that was dispersed. And that dispersed oil was at some point in the deep water column between about, conversions from feet to meters here, a deep layer. So as oil is coming up from depth, coming very hot under pressure, a lot of it was dispersed naturally, broken up into very, very small microscopic droplets, about the size of the width of a human hair. And those droplets, for some period of time, behave as if they're neutrally buoyant. So they just move out away, dispersed by currents, away from the source. And except right around the wellhead, once you go a mile or so away, if you scoop up some of that water and brought it to the surface, it would look clear. It would look just like drinking water out of a tap because the concentration was in parts per million. And farther away, it's parts per billion. So one of the complications with this whole thing has been to be able to describe that there's not this undersea lake of black oil, which is what a lot of people sort of got from some of the press coverage. That wasn't the situation. Highly dispersed, very small microscopic droplets is this one quarter of the pie chart. But dispersed and dilute doesn't mean benign. That can still have very serious consequences to the small creatures, the medium-sized creatures in the ocean. And so that part of the system we continue to remain very concerned about. So that's sort of the breakdown of the pie chart. That was our best calculation at the time as to where the oil went, to answer the question a lot of people were asking. That doesn't mean that oil is still in those different categories because a lot of it is being biodegraded naturally. And one of the fortunate things about this whole disaster has been the relatively rapid rate of degradation of much of this oil. We don't know exactly how fast it's being biodegraded. We've got a lot of different people working on those numbers. But we have now launched, the Unified Command has launched a very aggressive monitoring program now to get a better handle on exactly this subsurface part of the pie. How much is still out there, both the oil and the dispersant, if there's any left, where is it, what concentrations? both in the water column from the very shallow to very, very deep, and on the seafloor and in the sediments. So there's still a lot of things we don't know about the system, this effort to nail down what's remaining, I think, will be very, very helpful in helping us understand a question that a lot of people are asking, which is, where in the heck could 5 million barrels go? It just is such a large number, and it is a large amount. I think it was very confusing to people to think that it has to be out there someplace, so where is it? And the reality is, I think that a lot of it, a quarter of it was removed by the response action, a quarter of it was dispersed and is in the process of being biodegraded. And it just seems, I think, like a contradiction for a lot of people that if there's so much out there, where is it? Must be lurking someplace.
Doug, can I ask you to comment on that as well?
Yeah, the only thing I would add to it is I try to resist even using the term oil anymore because it was oil when it erupted from the broken well at the seafloor. It's been being processed chemically, physically, biologically from the get-go. And so if you think about it like a spewing volcano on the seafloor, but with different elements of the material that started out as oil being processed in different ways, in some cases together, in some cases not, moving up through the various layers of the sea, some coming to equilibrium and staying and moving laterally in different directions with the currents, some making it all the way to the surface, and then they're processing again, including with dispersants, some part of it sinking back through every layer. You can imagine a different set of trajectories for the different kinds of things, and with different consequences along the way. So it's not just oil bad, not oil good, because each of the steps along the way has a set of side effects. Even for that goes all the way to carbon dioxide and water, using up oxygen, then you end up demanding oxygen and yielding carbon dioxide, which is an acidifying agent in different levels of the sea. And all those microbial populations that have been induced that aren't there in those particular balances and ratios have been altered dramatically by the materials that they have eaten in the broad sense along the way. So you have all of these different perturbations that are then each cascading through the system with a set of profound effects we are just now beginning to appreciate. So I think Dr. Lachinko has it nailed exactly with that one proviso that I think there's still some accounting to do for certain things. And the ones that occur to me are, in addition to the polyaromatic hydrocarbons that everybody's talking about, that are persistent, with this light sweet crude, you've got up to 30% of benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, so-called BTEX chemicals that are aromatic, some of them are reproductive toxicants and even carcinogens. And so we've never had a situation where you had up to, 50 million gallons of that kind of material on the bottom of the sea and moving up through the middle layers of the sea. Mm-hmm. So we have no idea, frankly, where that stuff ended up. And okay. I would just love to see an accounting, and we'll get there sooner or later, mm-hmm. for which elements of the system were injured, to what extent, and then how all these various materials track, and therefore what the risks are to systems and to people who might be eating those materials.
Mm-hmm. Chris, LSU researchers like Linda Hooper-Bowie have expressed concern about being blocked access to information and even to the ability of their students to get down to oiled beaches for the purpose of taking samples in the early days of the oil spill. And even as recently as this week, Holly Bick, a researcher with the Hubbard Center for Genome Studies at the University of New Hampshire, expressed concerns about people who were attending the National Science Foundation Principal Investigators meeting in Florida, saying they also were still getting having problems getting access to samples even after making repeated requests for samples, and that drilling mud and Deepwater Horizon oil was not available for them to make comparisons to make sure that what they were looking at was actually from the well. Are you seeing problems amongst the people who are working for you in terms of getting access to data, for sharing data, whether it's from BP or from the government?
I'm not seeing huge problems in that respect. although getting oil samples is proving to be difficult. At the meetings that they held in St. Petersburg and New Orleans, the Unified Command held, the BP spokesman said that oil would be available to people that filled out a form and requested it. It turned out that the BP lawyers backpedaled on that one, and they said a little bit more has to be learned before we give the oil out. So there is some trouble in getting oil out for experimental purposes. But BP has assured me that that situation will be rectified in the near term. I still haven't heard, though. It's been a week or two.
Okay. And more importantly, do the universities have enough money to be doing the research that needs to be done? I know that there's, you know, it's now October, so that means a new funding year for the National Science Foundation, and the rest of the money for the first year of the BP money for research that will be for independent research is out there. But that still sounds like a drop in the bucket in terms of the amount of money that ought to be putting into this, right?
I think it absolutely is a drop in the bucket. And the Gulf, as Doug mentioned, has really suffered from not enough attention in the past. We need to be doing fundamental monitoring and observation on a regular basis, as well as experimental science that's oriented to dealing with understanding the processes going on better. We have a program called WAVESIS, for example, which is where we put a variety of instruments on oil company platforms and use that to get data on current and wave height and all kinds of things. It's very useful and was very helpful for making predictions of where the spill went. But it's very hard to keep that funded because there just isn't enough money there. The so-called IUS program, Integrated Ocean Observation Program, around the country is not adequately funded. It's not just the Gulf. We need to have more continuous measurements being made. I know the administrator is very sympathetic with that because she's run programs like that on the West Coast herself. So this is something that we need to devote more resources to, absolutely.
Okay. Mark, could I just add that the IUS observing systems that were in place in the Gulf, although they're not at the capacity that anybody thinks they should be, were extraordinarily helpful in our response. We were able to utilize a number of the gliders that are part of this, many of the buoys, many of the remote sensing, and fold that into the response to help us run the models, to help us validate the models, to help us understand what was likely in terms of just the movement of oil in the Gulf. So there was a really, just underscores the importance of having that fundamental information. And it highlighted the fact that we didn't have not only adequate understanding of the physical circulation of the system, especially near the coastline, but a real deep understanding of the biological, ecological processes that are so important to really understanding what impact this event is going to have overall.
Well, in that same vein, have there been any samples taken yet from the deep water coral reefs in the Gulf?
Yes.
Is that new?
We've had lots and lots of ships out there taking samples, water column, sediment, both the federal ships like NOAA's as well as a number of the university, either university vessels or NSF vessels that are used by university researchers. And so we actually have quite a few samples and a huge amount of sampling that has been done, just inordinate numbers of samples, some of which are still being processed. But it's a huge gulf, and we need more, which is why we're doing this very massive monitoring to get additional information, fill in places where we didn't have the kind of information, such as across the shelf, a lot more sediment samples, a lot of deep sediment samples. So there's just, it's a big gulf.
Sure, Ted.
Quickly, one place where information is particularly challenging is related to fishery stock assessments in the Gulf and the Southeast Atlantic as well, where they have tremendous numbers of reef fish species, very few of which have actually been formally assessed. So if you're trying to manage sustainable fisheries and you don't have basic information, then you're in real trouble. Then when it comes to post-spill situation, that's accentuated by the fact that the reliance on historical data that may and may not be relevant to future goal setting becomes an additional handicap. So getting the resources to the Southeast Fishery Science Center is going to be really important in the aftermath of the oil spill.
Kyle, yesterday, I think it's yesterday, Bill Riley said the record is replete with unrealistic risk assessments, a belief really that a major blowout like this could not happen. He said the industry also had wholly inadequate preparations for containment and response. Why did the industry allow that state of affairs to happen, and how can you guarantee that it won't happen the next time?
Well, certainly, I think you have to come into this issue with an understanding of our, and when I say our, I mean not only the industry, but also the Department of Interior's understanding of risk. Yes, there was clearly a belief, as we talked about earlier, that the procedures we had in place were going to be sufficient to avoid the type of incident that happened on April 20th. So I think our focus has been in terms of preventing a release like this. And that obviously is the most important thing, is preventing it in the first place. Clearly, an extraordinary set of circumstances occurred, and there was a release that was not prevented. We are redoubling our efforts going forward to ensure, and again, working in conjunction with the Department of Interior, to ensure that this does not happen again, and that, you know, that's a commitment that we make, and we will continue to make going forward.
As Riley was making these comments, he also was talking about the Minerals Management Service, saying that it was staffed by people who were undertrained, underfinanced, overworked, overmatched, and outgunned, very similar to what you were saying a bit earlier. It's only been 5 months since the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management was created, and the beginning of the revamping of a lot of those programs. So why should residents of the Gulf Coast or Alaska or California believe that that agency is now prepared to regulate offshore drilling, whether in deep or shallow water? How can we be guaranteed that we've got the staff available to regulate you guys to make sure you're doing things right?
Well, first of all, I'd like to address this issue of the, quote, cozy relationship that you alluded to in your question. I can assure you in conversations with my members, none of them thought that we had a cozy relationship. The regulators were there, and the regulators have always been there as watchdogs. That the so-called cozy relationship is a fallacy. That said, we certainly recognize that there does need to be a staffing up at the Department of Interior to ensure that they can not only review the permits, as I mentioned before, but an important aspect is with the new regulations that are now in place, it's very important that there is additional staffing at Department of Interior so that they can work with us, so that we understand exactly what it is that is required going forward. It's one thing to put out a regulation. That regulation is essentially a framework. But we need to know specifically what it's going to take to receive approval for a permit. So we need to work closely with Department of Interior, and we want to work again, not hand in hand, but we need to have a close enough working relationship so that we understand what is required of us moving forward. Now, getting to the last point, I think you've emphasized, and what I emphasized earlier, they are not adequately staffed, certainly not going forward. And I believe they requested four times the funding this year that they received. Clearly, the Department of Interior needs to get more adequate funding from the administration to ensure that they can work closely to provide the oversight necessary so that the oil and gas industry can resume operations.
So let me follow up on that last piece and point out that it's been repeatedly repeated in the media in the last couple of months that the tax rate for the oil industry in the United States is much lower than it is in other foreign countries. Am I hearing you guys saying that you're willing to pay a larger share of oil revenues to help underwrite the cost of regulation?
Let me correct the record.
You probably should be asking them.
The oil and gas industry pays a higher effective tax rate than virtually any other industry in the country. We pay an effective tax rate of, I believe, 48%. That is my best recollection. Do not quote me on that. Other S&P industrials pay an effective tax rate closer to about 30%.
But in other countries, those rates are much higher for their oil industries.
I'm comparing our industry to other industries here in the United States. And again, when you compare us to other industries, our effective tax rate is much higher than others. So the idea that we need to further tax the oil and gas industry really is not it is not helpful to meeting our energy needs in this country, because again, the more you tax an industry, the less they're going to have for reinvestment, and the more likely that those resources are going to move to overseas where there's a better economic climate. So if we're talking about energy security, if we're talking about economic viability for this country, putting additional taxes on one of the highest taxed sectors of the economy does not sound like a good idea.
Yeah, it may turn out to be unreasonable to expect an undergunned new agency to take on the new deputy in town role that we're talking about all by themselves. And one of the things LG wanted me to make sure to mention to you all is the possibility of creating a third-party review agency or board made of independent experts and perhaps modeled on the Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board or some of the other such bodies that are public-private partnerships between and among industry and regulators, independent scientists and others, to be able to have an arbiter of best practices day to day, to be able to keep track of what happens as this new industry develops out in the outer continental shelf.
Okay, Chris, I've got one more question for you, and then if you guys can start lining up, let's. Okay, well, how about we let two questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so get to the mics real quick. And Chris, this has to do with the state of Louisiana. The state of Louisiana has put a lot of its eggs in the basket of trying to get as much money as possible from the oil spill and putting it into coastal restoration. You're probably the wrong person to ask, but I'll ask it anyway. The coastal restoration program is obviously an important thing for the state of Louisiana, but at the same time, it does not necessarily, the extensive measures that are called for in those programs and the amount of money that they're talking about spending is not actually mitigation for the things that actually occurred in Louisiana during this spill. What should people be looking for when they're looking at what Louisiana is asking for?
I'm not really the right person to answer this, but obviously I think resources should be directed to dealing with the spill as a first priority and not directed to other issues. I also I'll go out on a limb and comment that very often engineering solutions that are devised for dealing with situations like the one we're faced in Louisiana are not necessarily as effective as one might think. And that is a big challenge.
Okay. And I want to remind people that our rules are that if you have a blue tag, you are first to ask questions in line. If there's time, but there's not going to be time, I can tell you that, then we allow others. But Joe, if you can ask the first question.
I write for S.E. Davitt. The question's my own.
It's about science communication. And I'm not sure, I apologize to Dr. Luchenko, because I think I will stipulate you've been consistent and accurate all along. Nonetheless, there's an issue about the pie chart or the oil budget or what do you I want to call it. I got the implication from something that somebody said that, oh, well, this was something that the press got wrong. Mm-hmm. But really, what happened was that Carol Browner was on the talk shows very, very early that morning, long before the press conference. And so it might be understandable that the press got a misimpression of what the results really meant. But, okay, so the question is, well, there's more, but is this the way to release science information before the report? You have the spin, and then the report comes, and you still aren't releasing the data behind it. And you say you have confidence in the conclusions because they've been peer-reviewed, but then you say you're not going to release the data because it hasn't been peer-reviewed. And so the question is, and you're all involved in science communication, so I wish someone else from the administration were here, but is this any way to release science findings or data?
So did everybody hear the question? We've got the little sign here that says, please repeat the questions, but I don't think we need to do that. I think that that's a perfectly legitimate question, and I think that we're going to be seeing a lot of analyses, internal and external, about how the administration can communicate findings in a way that is accurate and shares information in as timely fashion as possible. And I'll just give you a little insight into some of the discussions we've had and challenges that we've had. You know, as a scientist, I would prefer that we have peer-reviewed information that's gone through a very elaborate peer review process. And once that information has been validated by external independent individuals, then release it. I mean, that is the process that science would normally undergo, okay? The question is, in an event that's moving so rapidly where the normal peer review process takes weeks to possibly more, how do you balance the need to share information that you believe is accurate as quickly as possible while still respecting the need to have all the independent validation? And throughout this process, we have made a commitment to share information with the American people as quickly as possible, as long as we were convinced that it was accurate. And I think that it's a fair question as to our judgment sufficient, or do we have to have a much more lengthy, in-depth analysis as opposed to just a very concerted in-depth analysis, but not necessarily as lengthy and as peer-reviewed throughout. So many of the documents that we've released have been peer-reviewed, have gone through that process, but that takes much longer. And so there's a real tension here in terms of getting information out, sharing it, because people need to know, want to know, and yet the normal process of scientific checks and balances takes a longer period of time. So how do you, you know, how do you balance those two needs? And I think that's a legitimate question.
Chris?
Yeah, I remember getting a copy of the report when it was released, and I just said, oh no, they're going to get killed on this by the scientific community because they didn't really put the kind of backup information that they needed. And it was only a few minutes before my colleagues started mentioning to me that they'd seen it and they were rather unhappy with it. So I think that the political forces overwhelmed the scientific forces in the administration, and that was put out on a premature basis.
So that wasn't true, Chris. That wasn't politically driven. We were, the scientists were in good conscience trying to share information that we believed was accurate.
Okay. Okay.
So I want to dispel that notion.
Good. I'm glad. I think that it's critically important to have budgets, and I think it's critically important to recognize that our information improves with time, and that that they will, everyone will be viewed as a point in a long progression of improving our information. So I'm looking forward to hearing more as our information is better refined and as the oil continues to weather and degrade.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Blumink. I'm a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News in Alaska. I write about oil and gas and other resource extraction activities. This question is for Dr. Lubchenco, and it involves future drilling in the Arctic. As you know, Royal Dutch Shell recently resubmitted its applications to drill in the Beaufort Sea next year. And last year, your agency had submitted some comments to the then MMS about some concerns you had specifically related to the Chukchi Sea and to the North Aleutian Basin. As I recall, you didn't mention anything about the Beaufort. I was wondering if you're comfortable with the level of scientific information in the Beaufort, whether your opinion about drilling in the Arctic and in the Beaufort in particular has changed in the last months, and how you're communicating with the other permitting agencies about this.
We have at NOAA consistently been concerned about a number of aspects of drilling in the Arctic. One, lack of information, basic scientific information about the species and habitats that are there. Two, lack of response capacity to mount anywhere near like what we saw happen in the Gulf should an accident happen. Three, grave concern about the much more challenging situation of dealing with oil spill in very, very frigid waters, especially if there's ice present. And we have expressed those concerns to the former MMS during the exchange that you were referring to, and are continuing to be in dialogue with them about some of our concerns about continuing activities in the Arctic.
Just quickly to point out that today in the Federal Register, there's the notice of a draft environmental impact statement for the Chukchi Sea lease sale that already occurred. It's a supplemental, though, because of the challenge that went on after that occurred. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're next. If you could identify yourself.
Yes, hi. Liz Birch. I'm a professor at Sonoma State University. I'm not sure who can answer this question, but I spoke with a BP engineer who said that the company engineers were actually very frustrated. They knew how to stop the spill and were not being listened to by the company. I'm not sure if anybody can answer the question, but I'm wondering why BP did not listen to its own engineers.
I cannot speak for BP. That said, keep in mind, and I cannot vouch for the authenticity of that report. Nevertheless, keep in mind that BP was working in conjunction with the Unified Command. So all the activities in terms of containment measures that were attempted leading up to eventually the successful capping of the well, all those activities were conducted in conjunction with the Unified Command. So BP was not acting on its own, not solely on its own.
Emily.
I am Emily Gertz. This is, question is for Dr. Lubchenco.
How come I'm so popular?
In reporting this summer for On Earth magazine about how the situation for sea turtles up and down the East Coast might be affected in terms of the spill, I was told directly by a press officer that he could not schedule interviews for me with his wildlife rehabilitation staff because NOAA had said they had to approve all such requests, and he had not received that approval from NOAA. So what I'd like to ask you is, what were NOAA's stipulations or requirements to wildlife rehab professionals who were working with marine wildlife, who assisted with the recovery efforts in the Gulf, in terms of speaking with journalists?
And Jane, if I can expand that just a little bit.
I'm not even quite sure what she's asking, but go ahead.
Okay. I can simplify the question, having set it up.
Okay. I also ran into a similar situation with another researcher who yelled at me for using a quote from a story that was a couple of weeks old from that researcher, saying that they were getting blamed for giving an interview and they were not allowed to give interviews as part of the damage assessment process. So I guess if you could...
In a nutshell, this person told me he was afraid they would be retaliated against if he allowed me to interview his staff prior to receiving approval from NOAA, because NOAA controls the allowances to work with these animals, you know, giving exceptions to the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act.
So were these NOAA employees that both of you were talking about?
In my case, no.
No.
So they were
independent
people
researcher,
who had licenses from, or
they had, I don't know the name of the specific permit, but these are people who work professionally with rehabilitating sea turtles that are stranded or injured.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I obviously don't know the circumstances of these two situations. What I can tell you is that the Natural Resource Damage Assessment Process, NRDA, is building that process is all about building a legal case against the responsible party should it come to needing to go to court. And the NRDA process, for which there is a much more lengthy description and some handouts in the back of the room if you're interested, involves three different steps in the process. And information that was, historically, all the information that is gathered under NRDA has been not available for public dissemination. This time, this year, we made a decision to change some of that, to change as much of that as was possible without jeopardizing a court case. Specifically, the first step in the NRDA process, which is pre-assessment, we decided that any data that were taken as part of the pre-assessment phase could and should be shared publicly, that doing so would be in the interests of openness and transparency, but not compromise a court case. The other two steps in the NRDA process must require that information be not shared and part of building the court case. So these are legal overlays on, in this case, scientific efforts to obtain information to document the impact of the spill. And some of the information is available to be shared and some of it is not, for the explicit reason of needing to build a case, should that be the case. So, A, yes, some of the information is not available. B, this year marks a major departure in that whole effort because we made a decision. We proposed to the other trustees, so the NRDA process is overseen by a trustee council, which has federal trustees, NOAA, Department of Interior, and state trustees, the five states of the Gulf. And the trustee council agreed with us that, in fact, this pre-assessment stage could be made public. So I think that was a very important step, and it's just it's useful to simply recognize that part of the NERDA process, the way it must run, is that some of the information is not publicly available.
We're going to have to cut it off here, unfortunately, because we're just out of time. I want to thank all of our panelists for putting up with us and my questions, and I want to thank you very much for assisting.
Could I just say a final word?
Sure.
I want to do two quick things. One, is Ben Sherman here? Where is Ben? So I want you all to know, Ben Sherman is somebody that's been part of the SEJ family for a long time. I think this is his 14th SEJ meeting. And last year at this time, we were not sure what Ben's future would be. And I just have to say how delighted I am that he's here. And I want you all to recognize how wonderful it is to have him back and in good health with us. So thank you. And number two, very quickly, you all know that this is the 20th anniversary of SEJ. I just want to thank SEJ, the board of directors, the members, for having this be such a vibrant organization because it plays such a critical role in getting good information out to the public. I know that next year the meetings are going to be in Miami. I am very excited. I hope to be in attendance there. And I want to issue a challenge to all of you. You've got 1 year to learn to scuba dive. You should not go to this meeting without having your scuba certification. And if I'm there, come join me in the Florida Keys and go diving. Thank you.